countrywide on RTE Radio 1. Sponsored by Caller Gas, celebrating 80 years, bringing energy to Ireland's homes and businesses.
First, this wet Saturday morning, as announced earlier this week by the Environmental Protection Agency, the EPA, Ireland is failing to reach anywhere near our emission targets, especially when it comes to areas such as energy and transport. And of course, we need more power supplied from renewable energies and less emissions indeed from agriculture if we're to go anyway towards meeting a reduction in greenhouse gases. Now, anaerobic digestion. Yes, you heard that right. Anaerobic digestion might be a feeling some of you are having in your tummy this morning after a late night last night. But these AD units are a technology underused in this country, but one which can have a role both in limiting greenhouse emissions and also in supplying clean energy. Bernard Fox farms and runs an anaerobic digestion plant very near the border in South Armagh, and Suzanne Campbell went to meet him to look at the costs and potential gains for farmers and for climate from this relatively simple technology. So, Suzanne, good morning. So,
good
farmers,
morning.
If they had these anaerobic digesters, like the sort of machine you'd see in a Willy Wonka chocolate factory sort of thing, and all the grass and the rubbish that from farms or waste goes in one end and out the other comes gas. Simple.
Absolutely. Out the other comes gas and also fertiliser. So, I'll explain how it works.
Yeah.
It's less Willy Wonka and more slurry tank, if we'd like to visualise it that way. So it's a big, low, round silo. And on Bernard's farms, he has two of these. They're about, say, a concrete wall of about 3 metres high, and they're about 20 metres in diameter. And they're a big tank. And what anaerobic digestion means is it's exactly like composting. So if you've a compost bin out the garden, or anyone has a muck heap or a compost heap, that's using oxygen to decompose. Anaerobic digestion is sealing the oxygen out of it. So it's a sealed unit.
Okay.
So you put the material in, you can put grass, you can put slurry, you can put whole crop, which he does, and you agitate it. It forms a gas known as biogas, which is methane and carbon. He uses gas then to make energy. And the brilliant thing about it is that the organic material that comes back out, you can then spread onto your land. It's more bioavailable to land because it has the bad stuff taken out. It has less ammonia, less carbon, less methane. So it's a win for the environment, and it also stops you using so many artificial fertilisers.
So we don't have to put artificial fertilisers on the grass to make it grow to.
Exactly.
Make the
gas. And you're taking the bad stuff out and using it for energy. There's about 20 anaerobic digesters already in Ireland, but most of them are used for waste, like food waste, which is a different licensing system. And for farming and on the agri side, there's very little of it going on in this country. What you need is a good land bank. You need lots of material to go into it, and you need very deep pockets to start it off, which I will explain a little later on in the piece. So first of all, I went up to the farm of Bernard Fox, just over the border in Keady, South Armagh. He took over his family farm a few years ago. He's a civil engineer. He was always looking at alternative enterprises. Anaerobic digestion was the ideal solution, he felt, for their place. So he has put in a combined heat and power unit. So he uses the gas to fire two massive engines, and he sells that electricity onto the grid. And it's known as combined heat and power rather than just selling the gas. And he told me about his unit up there, just over the border.
What we're looking at here is two digestion tanks where we create the ideal conditions for anaerobic bacteria to operate, to actually decompose organic material. So you have a primary digester, secondary digester, each with mixing apparatus, heating apparatus, gas capturing apparatus, where solids and liquids are fed into on a regular basis and mixed, heated, etc. to optimum conditions for the biology to break that down, giving an end product which is primarily biogas which is 50-60% methane content, 30-40% carbon dioxide, with various other different trace gases, oxygen, sulfur, ammonia, etc. It's that biogas that we extract, scrub up, and we use it to fuel two large gas engines, which are then connected to generators, generating electricity and supplying that electricity back into the national grid.
So you have two options if you're into anaerobic digestion. You can generate the gas and, if possible, sell that gas. Or, like in your case, you're generating the gas from organic material to power engines to sell energy onto the grid. And that gas, of course, being methane and carbon, you're decarbonising greenhouse gases from what is agricultural material, from slurry, from grass, from silage. That's a very effective way to deal with those materials. You know, there's an amazing potential there.
Yes, it gives massive potential to decarbonise agri in general, whether it be the home farm here or, in my circumstance, working with various other local farmers to help them to meet their nutrient management requirements, help to remove the greenhouse gases from the slurries that I bring in, not only decarbonising the products at source, but then also displacing any chemical fertilisers by utilising the digested, which is the end product of the biofertilizer, which comes from the plant, to go back to the land to either grow the next crop, to help decarbonise what he's doing. Another great thing is, especially if it was a gas to grid scenario or gas to end consumer scenario, not only are you helping to decarbonise the food chain at source, but the actual gas produced can then be utilised by the end user, the likes of your big pharma, your food processors, etc., to actually decarbonise what they're doing also. So it's helping to decarbonise the full food chain.
So what Bernard's talking about there is gas to grid. So we sell the gas onto the grid, which means that that can be used by food processing companies and manufacturing. So basically, you've decarbonised the food at farm level, but also you're leaving fossil fuels in the ground later on then to process it. So it really is a win-win. Now, the sector, though, is really underdeveloped in Ireland, whereas in the rest of Europe, you know, you'll see anaerobic digesters, the big tanks in rural areas and villages, and they're supplying heat to homes and public buildings and schools. And it's not weather dependent, you know, energy like wave or wind. And right now, the Renewable Gas Forum Ireland, the RGFI, are petitioning government and Europe to support the building of more of these units. The benefits are huge, as we've heard, and also it's income for farmers who can sell silage or whole crop to AD units and supply people like Bernard. Now, the ideal unit is a 2 megawatt plant, and they're not cheap. They cost about 5.5 million euro to put in, and that 2 megawatt unit is about, I think it's about 4 times the size of Bernard's operation. And even at the level of what he's done, it's a huge investment, takes a lot of time, money and commitment, which I asked him about.
No, it's definitely not for the faint-hearted. Capital cost is very high, but not only that, there is a lot of operation and commitment to the system. In an agri-based facility, you have a large land bank to manage, to farm, and obviously battling against weather on that front.
So you're both farming the grass or taking grass and slurry off people and managing the machine, really, which is running, what, is it 24 hours a day?
It is, yeah. System needs to be running 24-7 for a minimum of 90% of the year. You know, so we need to be operating to max capacity for at least 8,000 hours plus a year. And yes, I work with various other different farmers locally, both dairy, beef, poultry, etc., in a range of different scenarios, both helping them to meet their nutrient management and slurry storage requirements, giving them an extra revenue in terms of being able to grow a crop to sell.
You're also, I suppose, in buying the food stock that goes into the anaerobic digester, is that providing income here to farmers, where we are looking at across rural Ireland, and especially around the border, the northwest and on marginal land, people not being able to make money off beef anymore and looking for other sources of income?
Yes, me personally, I'm probably bringing back £350,000 to £400,000 into the local economy in terms of feedstock supply, in terms of contracting costs to local contractors, mechanics, etc., etc., with additional money being spent on various different service contracts with the plant. May not be spent locally, but still within a 30, 40, 50 mile radius for engineers, spare parts, etc.
Is it ideal then as something that is both taking greenhouse gases out of the farming system and also providing income in a very different way? And do we need to make that transition in our heads quicker to solutions like this?
Yeah, I definitely think so. It's definitely not the silver bullet, but it's definitely one of the massive pieces in the puzzle in terms of a complementing technology which allows conventional farming to decarbonise what they're doing at very little cost, but also getting the various different knock-on benefits in terms of another possible revenue stream. Also then helping to boost the rural economy, actually bring higher level, higher skilled jobs back into the rural economy. You know, at the end of the day, we can't all live in Dublin. Mm. And it is a complementing technology. It's not a competing technology yeah. to conventional agri. Mm-hmm. But I know you've mentioned the beef industry in terms of, you know, there is a big issue there at the minute. Something like this does provide a very good, very necessary additional revenue stream for farmers like that to utilise more of the potential crops from their land bank to complement their existing scenario.
Yeah, that's Bernard Fox. Anaerobic digesters have been around a long time. Something relatively new here. But remember where you actually heard it first. And you could hear people saying, I have an anaerobic digestion problem after the Christmas party. Are your kids getting dressed up for Halloween?
They're very excited. Our house is full of cobwebs and spiders and all sorts of scary big creatures and decorations. You just, with children nowadays, they want the whole thing.
They do.
They do.
Well, for most of us, the only time of the year that we may think about bats is this time of the year, at Halloween especially. And if you want to be part of the relatively new craze of people who decorated their house and their hallways for Halloween just like Christmas, except you hang bats and other spooky memorabilia around this time of the year, well, stay tuned, because for Donna Mullen and Brian Keeley, who farm in County Meath, bats are not just for Halloween. They're trying to encourage bats to set up home in their farm all year round. And they took Hannah Quinn Mulligan on a tour of some outbuildings, and she began by asking Donna what they were hoping to find.
Well, we're hoping to find some bats. We have the place littered with bat boxes. We're trying different kinds of places for bats to live. We have old curtains hanging on the wall and bits of broken stonework.
Why bats?
Well, they're just fabulous little creatures. They're very harmless. They don't chew your wiring. They don't cause any problems. They eat a lot of insects. Each bat eats about 3,000 insects every night. They only have one baby every year or every 2 years. So they're very slow to reproduce. That's why the numbers are kind of going down rather than up.
I should have said it as well. You two met through bats. How did that come about?
Well, there was no Tinder at the time, so we had to find some other alternative way. You stop that.
Why? You're going to get killed now.
Right, Brian, you have a torch. Are we going to do some investigative work?
Yeah, we'll have a look and see. You know, it's a question of hide and seek, so we'll check all the boxes and see.
What types of bats do we have in Ireland? Because when I was growing up, I had this morbid fear of vampire bats, and it's, you know, kind of sucking blood or that kind of thing. So what types of bats do we actually have in Ireland?
Well, we don't have any vampire bats, so you're safe enough.
And what's the most common bat in Ireland?
I suppose the soprano pipistrelle or common pipistrelle. What would you think, Brian? Both of them are fairly common. Brown long-eared is common too.
Is it the case that there's a male sort of bachelor pad and then there's a female area as well?
Yeah, with the bat boxes that people put up, you know, they're pretty much like these student hubs. But, you know, you wouldn't want to live there for all your life. And the females decide that they want somewhere cosier to have their babies. So that's when they move into a lot of houses.
And I know you're involved in the GLOS scheme for cereal crops. I know in the GLOS scheme that farmers can have bat boxes as well.
The GLOS scheme has been great. For the first time this year, we got an owl for the first time on a farm.
Was it attracted by the birdseed crop?
I say, yeah, by the birdseed crop. The mice, obviously, they come with the birdseed crop. So we're putting bile boxes. Every year we pick one species and we kind of do everything on our farm for that one species. So hopefully it'll be owls this year. Did you find anything, Brian?
Yeah, there's a bat in the box there.
That's really amazing. So he's a male, that's what you're saying?
Yes, yeah, that's why he's so grumpy, because at this time of year the hormones are high, so because they mate at this time of year, and then they go into hibernation now shortly. And he's calmed down because he's, you know, once they like being squashed, feel more relaxed.
Can I rub him? Can I just see his
What's probably his head? Not his face, because he's a bit grumpy, so he probably would.
Oh, he's so soft. Yeah. That's amazing. Brian, are the numbers something that we should be concerned about in Ireland? Are different breeds endangered almost?
We don't know really historically what the numbers were like, but we do know from things like studies in Britain where the greater horseshoe bat dropped by a total of 99% in 100 years. So we know that the drop can be quite substantial, and the difficulties in getting the numbers back is huge, because as Donna mentioned, if you only have one young per year, it's very slow to replace any losses.
Is the horseshoe bat in the west of Ireland, is that an important population kind of repository for the whole of Europe?
Oh, it is. It's one of the largest populations of the lesser horseshoe bat in Europe at this time.
The odd time a bat comes into your house and it can be panic station. What should people do if they do find a bat in their house?
The main thing is just open the windows and let them out, or just put a tea towel on them and put them out. Put them out on an upstairs windowsill because they need to drop to fly again. They're not great at taking off from the ground.
If there was any one thing that people could do at home, what would you want them to do?
Well, everybody actually has a bat box that's stuck to their house and it's called your fascia board. And if you can make a little hole in your fascia board at the eaves, that will let bats in. And there's a lot of maternity roosts in fascia boards. Again, you need the hole about the size of your thumb. So another thing, I suppose, if they're in your attic, you know, don't worry, they will be gone at the end of August, September. But these people are just doing an amazing job. Anyone who puts up with bats in their attic over the summer, they're really like, these people are just crucial to conservation. And, you know, so many people in both rural and urban Ireland are doing the piece. And that really is a very important piece for nature that they're doing.
Yes, that's Donna Mullen talking about her love of bats on her farm in County Meath. And she was chatting there along with Brian Keeley to Hannah Quinn Mulligan. Born in Belnalec in County Fermanagh in 1945, Father Brian D'Arcy will next month celebrate 50 years since his ordination. He's lived a roller coaster life within the priesthood, but also in music, broadcasting, fundraising and writing. And he's just published his latest book, a memoir titled It Has to Be Said. During the week, I went to Belfast to meet Father Brian in the BBC Radio Ulster studios, where he records his weekly show, which he continues to love doing. And so I put it to him that if he had left the priesthood, would he have ended up as a full-time broadcaster?
Probably not, no, probably not. I think if I hadn't joined the priesthood, I'd have been a bus driver, like my father.
Yeah.
And that's what I would have probably ended up being, and it would have been fine. It would have been great. Connie Lynch, a good friend of yours, God be good to him, used to say that if I hadn't been a priest, I'd have made a great show band manager. Because
Like
Connie was himself. Because he said, you know the punters, you know what it's like, you're able to organise crowds and bring them in and all the rest of it. And I might have been that all right, you know, I might have done that.
But because of your great love of music.
Because of my great love of music, which before I became a priest, I just always loved music. I had a study as a child, much to my father, God be good to him's dislike. I studied with a wireless, as it was called then, at my ear, and the only pop music I could get was Radio Luxembourg 208 on the dial.
And you talk about obviously Elvis and the Beatles back in the 50s and 60s. They were your great, I suppose, inspiration and entrance into your love of music and onto the show bands. A lot of people know you obviously through your writing in the Sunday World and journalism, and you've written many books, this being the latest of them. And the man that inspired you was a former Taoiseach.
The man who started me writing definitely was a former Taoiseach, Albert Reynolds. Himself and Jim, the brother, had started having ballrooms at 16 or 17 ballrooms around the country. He decided that Spotlight wasn't giving him enough publicity at that time. So he got a man who had a printing press in Longford, Jimmy Malloy, God be good to him, was, and he started a programme called The Dancing News, as distinct from Spotlight. And they asked me, I was walking up the street one day in Dublin without a penny in my pocket, with a Roman collar on me, about 19 years of age, and Addy Masterson, whom I knew because he was involved in the band business, he stopped me and he says to this man, whom I didn't know, this young fella will write for your paper. The man, as it turned out, was Albert Reynolds.
Wow. And
I don't think there's a week since that. It was 1965, I think. I don't think there's a week since that I haven't written for some paper or something.
And you're still writing. And this memoir, it is a memoir, and I'm intrigued by the title, which is It Has to Be Said. What inspired the book title, It Has to Be Said?
I had a whole list of titles in my on a sheet, and by the way, that was the very first one that was on it. Now, there was maybe 20 others, and everybody didn't like the title at the beginning. But by the end of the book, when they knew what I was trying to do, they said, It Has to Be Said is it.
What were you trying to do?
And what I was trying to do was, I'm nearly you know, I'm near the end of my life. When I started out in the priesthood, there were 97% of the people were going to Mass or their church, whatever the case may be. Now, well, you could take any figure. If it's over 65, there's probably 40% of them going. If it's when you if you go below 30, it's probably 9 or 10% who go regularly to Mass, go to funerals and things like that, but regularly to Mass and so forth. So, you know, gosh, what did I do wrong? What did we do wrong that lost the people of Ireland and the world? The world has changed, the people have changed, things have changed. But the church must take its blame too, because we never actually spoke to the people.
But you're carrying that on your shoulders,
yeah,
Brian.
But you see,
and
David,
you tried to change.
Well, I did.
You can't blame yourself
in
that regard.
You see, I could do that. I mean, if anybody has an out, I probably am one of the ones who has an out. Who get under the. But you know, you have to be responsible and mature about it too. I'm still a priest. You know, I'm still a priest. Despite what the Vatican wants, I'm still a priest. So I stayed, you know, and I'm part of the clerical club, whether I want to be or not. I am. I don't adhere to it in any way. But nevertheless, we have to say we didn't listen to the people. That, where did I start off with? The bands taught me the punter is right. And I believe that the Holy Spirit is still talking to the people and we're ignoring them. And we're trying to impose an edifice from the top that the people say it means nothing to me. So what am I doing it for? Why don't we sort of ask the people, and the Holy Spirit's guiding them too, and say, listen, how can we both reach a merciful God who is going to save us instead of condemn us, who is going to love us instead of hate us, who is going to be the very centre of our lives, that we can do that? Because that's the message of the gospel. And unless I do that, you know, it won't happen. Mm. So I think there are things like that that have to be said before I die. There's no point in writing it. There's a story in the book about Cardinal Martini, and he wrote the most brilliant thing about the future of the church, but he wouldn't allow it to be published until after his death.
Yeah.
I think that is one of the greatest tragedies of all time. A cardinal who could have been pope and should have been pope, was too afraid of whatever this structure is within the church, the clericalism of the church. He was too afraid to say anything until after he was dead.
Even at the senior position that he was actually in.
That's the saddest thing. And this is why I think I want to say it before I die.
Yeah. Because you talked there about the Vatican. You were censured by the Vatican 8-9 years ago. And it's amazing all you've gone through in your life. And that was the lowest point for you, was to get that letter from the Vatican, which you weren't allowed to keep. It was read out to you in a car, in a car park in Quinn's Corner, three times for you to get your head around. Basically, you were getting wrapped over the knuckles and told, keep your mouth shut.
It was worse than that, Damien.
Was it?
You could put up with that. Yeah, you could put up with that. But the threat in the letter was that unless I stopped criticising the church, I would be excommunicated. Not just removed from the priesthood. Excommunicated.
Which means you couldn't even receive communion.
Couldn't receive communion. Exactly.
Despite all that you had done in the name of God, in the name of the Catholic Church, in the name of Rome, you were being threatened because...
Exactly.
Was it because what you were writing in the Sunday World?
Yes, it was because of what I was writing in the Sunday World. Probably because of what I was doing in interviews as well. Now, as far as I know, there were photographs of articles I had written in the Sunday World sent to the Vatican. Now, there's a humorous side to this because I had to go to the Sunday World editor and say they want to censor everything I write. I'm not going to do that because I, as a journalist, a lifelong journalist, member of the NUJ, I couldn't let anybody censor what I'm writing. So I spoke to the editor of the Sunday World at the time, Colman, and I said to him, you know, that there were photographs of articles, photocopies of articles I had written in the Sunday World, handed to the people in the Vatican. And he says, God, that's our story for tomorrow. even the Pope reads the Sunday World. So, you know, there's a journalist for you.
I'm trying to get my head around this. So suddenly clippings of the Sunday World are in St. Peter's Square being gone through. A letter is sent off to you telling you to watch yourself or you'll be excommunicated. Where did the initial complaint come from? You see, you were portrayed as this, you know, celebrity priest almost. You're on the radio, you're writing in the racy Sunday World. And all that. Do you think that kind of maybe peed off some... Not maybe other priests, but maybe very staunch traditional Catholic people in this country who just felt you were getting a bit big for your boots? Or have you ever got to the bottom as to who made the complaint?
No, I have no idea who made the complaint. None at all. And at this stage of my life, I don't want to know because, right. You know, it was
but do you suspect it might have been that or another priest?
I suspect it's colleagues.
Right.
I suspect who did it. I don't know. But
was there ever a feeling? Was it ever said to you, Brian, look, you're either a priest or a journalist. You can't be both.
No. To be honest, that was never said. It was said to me by bishops and so forth and so forth. But the great Cardinal Tomás Sofí said, you know, I wish to God I could do what you were doing and say the things that you were saying. So don't ever give that up because he said that is the people you should be talking to and that is where you should be at.
And is that censure still in place, Brian? Do you have to watch what you're saying?
Technically it is. The difficulty with it, of course, the thing is I can't allow myself to sit under that, because then I would be succumbing to the biggest temptation of all, is to ignore the Holy Spirit, and that, you know, and have a comfortable life and succumbing. That is not what it's about. If it's the truth, it's the truth, and if the truth of the gospel is that Jesus saves everybody, there is nobody in this world can stop me loving God or you loving God if you want to, and there is nobody in this world who can stop God loving you if you accept that. So I've got to say that and keep saying it.
Yeah.
And if they throw me out, fine, they throw me out, but I'll still keep saying it.
Well, I often wonder, Brian, I'm reading your book, and from the first day that you walked into the Graham in Enniskillen, right through to the abuse you suffered in Mount Argus, to the all the other dark times that you've had in your life, including feeling like ending your life almost around that time of the censure as well. And your mother and father, unusually for people of their time, didn't want you to actually become a priest or didn't encourage it. Would have been seen maybe in the 50s and 60s as a great thing for your son to become a priest. That wasn't the case with your parents.
No.
And even Bono, I think, said to you at one stage, what are you doing still a priest? And
that's not the language you use, but he did. That's
more unparliamentary language. And it's something you still regret when you visit your parents' grave, that you didn't maybe listen to them. So why are you still a priest, or were you ever tempted to just walk away from it?
Oh, many times. Many times I've been tempted to walk away from it. And I think that's...
Do you feel a sense of guilt on your mother's behalf?
No. I would... The sense of guilt is that I didn't speak honestly enough soon enough. That's the only guilt that I have, because I bought this thing of the clerical church and that, you know, that there's a hierarchy and you should know your place in the clerical church and, you know, speak when you're spoken to and that others above you knew better. Mm. I did believe that for maybe 20 years.
But why didn't you walk?
Why didn't I walk was because every time I stopped to pray about it, I discovered that I think God wants me to be a priest. Otherwise, I wouldn't be one. And there's no other answer to that. Mm. And you have to try and do what God wants you in life, no matter what it costs you. You know, I would love to have been a father. I'd love to have been a husband. I'd love to have married. I'd love to have had a lot easier life than I have, to be honest. But at the same time, there's a vocation in it. There's a calling in it. Mm. And as I see, my calling is to speak the truth to power. That's my vocation.
How would God then feel about what happened here in your mind then this week with the liberalisation of abortion and same-sex marriage laws in Northern Ireland?
I think he would say two things. In gay relationships or whatever it is, you know, God made you the way you are. Try and find the peace of your life as best you can. And it's up to you to live a respectful life and as best you can, according to your conscience. And if you do that, God will understand it, because God doesn't make second-hand goods. Abortion is something that I can't agree with at all. And I've said that all the time, no matter
what. And I'm sure you've come across many people
However, those people, and I've dealt with them for my entire life, dealt with people who had to choose an abortion. For them, it was the only choice they could make. And my job to them is to bring them the love of God, who understands. If I can understand the crisis that they were in and made them make choices that they didn't necessarily want to have, then there's no doubt about that, that God can. God may not love the sin, but God always loves the person in difficulty.
Mm. So is Northern Ireland a better place this week?
I don't think it is. I think it's a better place that people have choices to make. I can never think it's a better place that life is taken, wherever it is. And God knows we in Northern Ireland know an awful lot about that. Where life is taken needlessly. But what I do say is I don't like gay relationships being lumped in with abortion. I think they're entirely different things. So they're not the same thing. They're not the same agenda. They're not the same. What we have got to do is to understand that this is what we think is right and this is what we think should be. However, if you can't reach that, God is still there walking hand by hand with you to try and help you to achieve some sort of peace of mind, and you badly need it. That's if you want peace of mind. If you don't want peace of mind, then anything I say is not going to be much helpful to you.
And then again, what do you think God's impression is of the idea of ordaining women?
Well, to be honest with you, that's one of the things that got me into trouble.
Yeah.
So I have to be extremely careful. My own personal opinion is that we need to speak about that. I cannot find, and I've studied this for 20 years, went to America to do a special course on it, and there were the best scripture scholars in the world, two of them belonged to the same order as myself, and they went into deep research, and they could find nothing in the Bible or tradition which actually forbids a woman to be ordained.
So it's a man-made law, really.
No, the church will say it's not. That's the point. Okay. The church will say it's not, that Jesus did not ordain women. Mm. And that's not a good enough answer anymore. There may be some theological reason, which nobody has ever explained to me. And right. If there is, I accept that. But the reason given that Jesus didn't ordain women as being a reason not to ordain women now is, to me, just plain foolish to ask anybody to believe that. He didn't ordain Irishmen either, but we have ordained a fair number of them ever since. The married law, the married priest is a man-made law. And that, I think that just, nobody should be forced to be a celibate to become a priest. Nobody.
And it is the root of a lot of the problems and the darkness that you and other priests have had to suffer over the years. Mm. And you do talk, Brian, very frankly in the book about, you know, the darkness in the pit of your stomach as a result of the two episodes of sexual abuse, which we won't go into now. One when you're 11 in Oma, and the other, as you said, in Mount Argus when you were 17. But there's a lot of great stories in the book too.
Yes.
And your love of sport. I didn't know you were a good footballer with Fermanagh. You could have actually made the county if you didn't go on to study to be a priest, like your father before you.
He did. He played Fermanagh and Tyrone, and he played Oma for a long time as well.
So that's where your love of Gaelic.
Our house was just a total Gaelic house.
Yeah.
You know, the club meetings used to be held in our place. And I was delighted with my wee club this year, Benelec, which is a small, very small club. And 2 years ago, they were playing junior. And this year, they drew at Derrigonley in the senior championship. One kick of a ball between them. Now, the guys in Derrigonley are all good friends of mine as well. So there's none of that. But I actually remember the time when emigration in the 60s, and the meetings were held around a fire. Sandy McConnell, Jimmy Timoney, Jimmy McGoran, people like that were all around the fire trying, for some reason, they had paid 17 and sixpence to hire a field that they could play football in, and because they had played 17 and sixpence, they had no money to buy a ball.
God.
And my father wrote a letter to a former footballer who went to England asking if the fellas in England would club in to buy a ball. God. And the crack that comes in our house the night that a ball arrived from England.
And never did you think when you were a young lad then that, you know, all these years later you'd be still waiting for Fermanagh to win an Ulster Championship. But you're a resilient man, Brian. There's no doubt about it when it comes to supporting Fermanagh. I see you in Clonus and Croke Park at matches all over the year. You love Fermanagh, you love where you come from. Over the years, you're a man that was the go-to man to mediate in, and there's, you obviously tell the whole drama of your involvement in the Desi O'Hare kidnapping. What has been happening back home with Quinn Holdings? How do you feel about that, Brian? Is there a role for you at all there? I know you're close to the Quinn family as well.
Very close to Kevin Lunny as well. It's difficult to talk about it in public because it's a far more complicated than you know, media tend to oversimplify things. Some others who make statements tend to do the same, none of which is true. So there is a deep thing there about an area that had nothing, and suddenly, because of the efforts of basically one man and Kevin Looney and Liam McCaffrey and the boys as well, but it resulted eventually in a huge place of employment for not only for Manor but for Kevin Looney. Mistakes were made and it was all taken back. And so nobody wants the deceit going back to that. What happened to Kevin Looney should never have happened to any human being. I wrote that at the time, I said it at the time, and I spoke it at the time, and I'll say it wherever it does need to be said. There is no ifs or buts or excuses about it. That should not be, happen, and it will never be allowed to happen. But I don't think it's also fair to point the direction on, without any evidence on another person. So you can't do that.
But
either.
Is there a resolution here, Brian?
It's very difficult. I have been working with behind the scenes quite quietly. The more I work, the more complicated it becomes, I have to say that. But the one thing we have to ensure is that the rule of law is kept, no matter who it applies to. There can be no reason. The second thing we must do everything in our power to maintain jobs to an area that nobody else has any interest in. Irish government, British government, Northern Ireland government, none of them have the slightest interest in that border area. So we must keep employment as best we can and keep the fruits of the employment as best we can in there, because everything depends on that.
Yeah. You're 74 now. You're looking, and you know this because people will say to you, you're looking young, fresh, fit, you're healthy. But you talk an awful lot about your own sense of mortality and lack of peace of mind. Do you feel that you won't have that peace of mind until the next life? Or why are you talking so much, I suppose, about, you know, your time is coming to an end and that all your friends are gone? There's a little bit of morbid talk there in the book.
But you have to be realistic about it as well. I mean, my father died at 70, my brother died at 70, I'm 74.
Right.
So, you know, genes do mean something. The way I look at it at the moment is, if I die tomorrow, fine. If I die in 10 years' time, fine, provided that I live. I'm not interested in dying. I'm interested in living as best I can. I have a rush to do as much as I can while I'm still alive.
Will you retire as a priest, or will you just keep going?
I don't think that's in the future's ahead. I mean, the Vatican could read this book and say you'll retire quicker than you thought you could. But
hopefully not.
But if they do that, I'll go on doing what I'm doing now, because nobody can stop me being as good a person as I can be. I am not going to let them abuse me again. I am going to take control of my life. That's everybody's duty to do that. Make your choices, live by them, and live fully as much as you can. You know, somebody told me, Gene Fitzpatrick was talking to me during the week, and he left me a lovely little phrase. He said, you know, charity is patience with others. Hope is patience with yourself, and faith is patience with God. That's not a bad little line.
Not a bad line. Father Brian D'Arcy speaking to me earlier this week. His book is called It Has to Be Said, and it's published by Sleevebone Productions and now on sale. Well, from Balnalek, we go now to Shanghai. And James O'Donnell of Borbee is on the line. Good morning to you, James. Thanks for hanging on. Big news this week that more Irish beef factories have been sanctioned and approved to sell beef into China. How significant is this, James?
Good morning, Damien. It's tremendous news, and it comes after a lot of work by the Department of Agriculture, the Minister, the Embassy and ourselves here. So now we have 19 plants approved to export to China. That's up from 7 in the previous situation. So that gives us a significant opportunity to play in this market. And here in China, China imports in the region of 1.5 million tonnes of beef a year, and it's a growing market.
It's importing three times what we produce altogether.
It's importing three times what we produce, indeed, yes.
So the potential for Irish beef must be huge if this demand is growing.
Indeed it is. The market in the last 2 years has doubled, and it will continue to grow, and the market is extremely strong for all protein, both beef and pork at the moment. And that's as a result of some difficulties with the local production. So China will import a significantly higher percentage of its requirements from abroad for both beef and pork over the next 2 years.
And that is because more people are becoming urbanised and are being introduced to westernised diets and looking for sources of protein. Is that the reason that there's this newfound, I suppose, demand in recent years for beef?
Indeed, beef would not be traditionally something in the Chinese diet. Incomes are increasing here. People are moving to urban locations, and as a result of that, people's disposable income increases, and they eat more beef and more pork. So that's a trend we're going to see continue in the future.
And are those shipments ready to go as and from now?
Well, the factories are approved, and obviously it's going to take some time to put in place the system. And in terms of shipping the product, it takes about, from once beef is shipped from Ireland to here, it takes about 6 weeks for it actually to arrive. So we will see the product arriving, the additional product arriving here in about 6 weeks' time.
Okay, listen, it's great news. Sorry I didn't have enough more time to talk to you about it, James, but it is something we'll come back to. It is really big news, and let's hope it actually it gives a timely boost to hard-pressed farmers at the bottom of the food chain. They'll be hoping that they get some return out of this good news.